Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. The weather was a story which received lots of coverage in the airwaves this week. Coastal communities, towns, villages and cities were all hit by the impact of savage storms and high tides. Limerick City was particularly badly affected. And on Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, Brian O'Connell was out and about with some of the residents of St Mary's Park to assess the damage. The first voice you'll hear is that of Michael Cody, the man whose picture appeared in a number of national newspapers on Monday when he was photographed rescuing his neighbours from their homes in his horse and sulky.
These houses here, they was all full as well this morning. You know, they're coming down here in boats this morning, now they were rescuing the people. And only before we had the old horses there, for to get them out, they wouldn't have got out at all, like.
So were you the man pictured with the horses,
with the horse
rescuing people with the
horses? That's
horse.
Right, yeah. I was going up and down that road there since 8 o'clock yesterday, up to last night again, you know. What can you do? We have to try and help one another, like. But I never see it, and I'm down here 50 odd years, and I never see it like that.
There's a man getting ready now for tomorrow.
He's got the bags.
You're ready, Pa. You've got the sandbags out ready for tomorrow?
Just ready for tonight now, because we're after getting another warning. There's going to be another high tide, and there's gales due. You know what I mean? The houses are flooded, completely destroyed. There's a niece of mine living over in one, and we were over today, tried to help clean it out in the hole, but everything inside it is destroyed. At least a foot and a half of water inside in them, like, you know, so.
And tell me, you're staying put anyway, are you?
Oh, we're staying put. We're tough out.
And my name is Esther Casey, and I have my daughter Simone, and I'm rearing four grandchildren as well. And we had to get out of our home last night to go to my daughter in Castle Dry. And now my back is damaged inside, where a young pup died. This was like a big swimming pool now. It was full.
And you've sandbags all around the front of the house here. And what about insurance then? Will insurance cover?
Oh no, this is a corporation house. So we don't know what's going to happen to see. Will they clean up the area for us? I mean, there was a lot of damage. Shreds and all was broke out there along to me. 12-week-old pup, wasn't it? Yeah, it belonged to her. And we still have him outside in the back now in a bag until the other crowd comes in to take him away, because you have to hold on to him there.
God, it's going to take a few bob, isn't it, to put the whole area back to where it was?
Well, I won't be paying for it anyway, let me tell you that, because I'm only on a widow's pension. And only for the army now that took us out just Friday night.
It was the army that got you out?
Yeah, brought the whole lot of us out.
Had you a car parked in the driveway or anything, no?
Me? I'm looking to have a house, money car.
From Brian O'Connell's report on the Today Show on Monday. The community spirit, which was so much in evidence in Brian's report from St Mary's Park, was also displayed by the people of Passage East in Waterford, who were successful in their attempts to rally together and save their village from further flooding on Wednesday night. On Thursday morning, fisherman Michael Connors told Sean about how he and his neighbours went about building their own defensive wall.
Monday morning we got our eyes hammering all together. We were caught unaware. But yesterday evening, with the help of the local council, the civil defence, and I suppose 100 local people, the council provided something like 100 ton bags, a mini digger, a JCB, two lorries, 8 or 10 council workers. There must have been 15, 16 civil defence. But we were delighted with what we achieved.
But what did you do, Michael?
Well, what they actually did was they put the ton bags across the top of... We have three piers run into the village. And they put the ton bags across there. Now, at one stage last night, the surge was 3 feet up on the bags. So you could imagine if that had got through, the whole village would have been totally destroyed. But it was very effective and very simple, you know.
This was the point at which the sea had its most powerful access into the village. And who came up with the plan that this was what is needed, 100 people and so many bags and all the rest of it?
Well, Monday morning, the chap by the name of James Ellis and myself met, and we decided that we call a meeting, an emergency meeting at 1 o'clock. And this came up, there was a few politicians turned up to it, and James himself came up with the idea about the ton bags, which was absolutely brilliant.
What about the height of the waves and the ferocity of the seas last night, Michael? As a fisherman, you'd have a fair bit of experience.
Yeah, well, at the surge coming to the dock, it would have been around 4 to 5 feet. That was, but at the eastern southeast side of the village, there'll be a lighthouse there, and there must have been 20 feet high surging coming in there. It was savage there now.
As bad as you've ever seen it?
Never seen it as bad. Never seen it as bad. On all my born days, I never seen anything like it.
Michael Connor is talking to Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. The controversy surrounding RTE's decision to pay out €85,000 in damages over remarks made about John Waters and members of the Iona Institute on a recent Saturday night show continued to receive lots of coverage this week, culminating in these contributions from TDs John Lyons and Jerry Buttimer in Leinster House on Thursday.
There's two people, I think, in here at the moment who knows what homophobia feels like, who knows what it's like to be called a queer, to be called a fag, to be called a gay. Only recently, I think just before Christmas, I walked from my own house around to the centre where a bunch of teenagers called me gay or some other name they call us. You know, I thought, you know, I was living in a society where this stuff isn't acceptable anymore. But yet, when people challenge people on these issues, and that's what Rory O'Neill did on the Saturday night show, he called it what it is. When it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, looks like a duck, it must be a duck. And I think RTE were completely wrong and bang out of order when they got numerous types of legal advice saying, in fact, that perhaps they should not even pursue and give any sort of compensation out. RTE got it wrong, and everybody in the public knows they got it wrong, and RTE need to come out and let us know that they got it wrong. Otherwise, there will not be confidence in our national broadcaster to mediate any debate with confidence, particularly around issues that affect my life and the people who love me and love all the other people who aren't treated properly in this society.
We as a society and this Parliament has a role to play, and the national broadcaster. And Minister, RTE got it wrong. They got it completely wrong, and they folded their tent in. And in this house this week at Kioncorla, in this Oireachtas, we were told as gay people that it's a matter of social re-engineering by the gay ideological movement. And I'm quoting from a member of British Shannon. And Kioncorla, let me put in the record this house as I've done before. I speak here not just as a gay person, but as a member of society who wants to be treated equally. I've been beaten, spat, chased, harassed and mocked like Deputy Lyons because of who I am.
TDs Jerry Buttimer and John Lyons speaking in Leinster House on Thursday, as heard on Friday's Morning Ireland. And afterwards, Jerry Buttimer spoke further to Cathal McQuilla about the RTE apology.
Having read the reports of the apology, having listened to RTE personnel, RTE has a responsibility to facilitate fair and balanced debates of issues of public importance, i.e. this issue of marriage equality, as an example. And I just wasn't happy with the response that RTE gave. I thought they folded too quickly. They didn't publish the nature of the advice they were given. They didn't reveal who gave it to them, what was the nature of the event, of the advice. And to me, as a national broadcaster, RTE has a responsibility to all of us as citizens. And central to their obligation as a public broadcaster must be an entitlement of those participating in your programme or other programmes to be able to voice honestly held opinions and make fair comments.
True, but you know what the money is there for the licence payers give to RTE. It's to make programmes. It's not to defend legal actions which your lawyers tell you you're going to lose.
Yeah, but RTE must act as a fair arbitrator and stand by the rights of people and its programmes to voice their honestly held opinions. Otherwise, it acts to undermine its public service remit.
Jerry Buttimer talking to Cathal McQuilla on Friday's Morning Ireland. The RTE executive who played a key role in making the decision to award the payout was the head of television, Glenn Killan. On a Wednesday's News at One, he explained the process which informed that decision to Richard Crowley.
In the run-up to the settlement, RTE explored every single possible avenue available to us other than financial remedy, such as a right of reply on the show and various other clarification statements on the show, but those were rejected. So in the interest of based on advice we received both internally from legal and from very senior counsel externally with significant experience in this field, and being faced with six separate legal cases, six separate potential costs and six separate settlements, we took the view that this was the most prudent course of action in the public interest in terms of spending public monies responsibly.
Did all six reject your suggestions for mediation, for an apology or for some right of reply? All six did,
yes.
They? And were they legally represented all along the line, each of them, and separately?
Yes. No, there were, the majority were represented by one solicitor, and I believe another complainant was represented by another solicitor.
And what, and I know that they rarely talk in short sentences, but what in summary was your legal advice?
The legal advice, I mean, look, we were faced with a problem post the broadcast of the Saturday Night Show. It's not something that we would have wished happen, but we had to take a decision. And the advice was that we were very, very unlikely to win a case should it go to the courts.
That's how they worded it, was it? Very, very unlikely?
I can't recall the exact wording, but in summary, Richard, that's basically the gist of it.
It may have been a prudent move financially, and you may have saved the station money. But from a public relations point of view, is it not something of a disaster? Because RTE has become the story, and RTE's coverage of the story has become the story. It hasn't gone away.
I don't believe RTE has become the story. I think RTE is an element of the story because it was aired first on RTE. I think as managing director of television, it's my job to make decisions based on the facts that are presented to me. And the facts as they were presented to me, based on people who know far more about this issue than I do, was that it would be reckless to pursue this through the courts.
And you're not
reckless in terms of the use of public monies. So we sought to settle.
And you're not concerned that RTE will be seen as something of a soft touch?
I think this interview demonstrates very clearly that RTE is not a soft touch, and I think Minister Hogan would back those views up.
Soft touch in terms of legal claims that those who are of a litigious bent might see us as a soft touch.
Look, if we believe we have a case to defend, we will defend it as forthrightly and as vigorously as we possibly can. But we won't do so recklessly.
RTE's head of television, Glenn Killan, talking to Richard Crowley on Wednesday's News at 1. Issues surrounding homophobia, gay marriage and the acceptance of gay people in Irish society were widely discussed as a result of the RTE controversy on air this week. On Wednesday's Mooney, Derek spoke to last year's Eurovision entrant, Ryan Dolan, who spoke openly and honestly about how he struggled with his sexuality in his teens before coming out to all members of his family when he turned 21.
Thinking back now, I just wish that I had of no came out about it a long time ago, maybe when I was 15 or 16.
Why? What difference would it made?
Because I just think my youth was wasted worrying all the time about it. And I think if I had been more open about it back then, I would have been happier. You know, I really, really did struggle, you know, growing up with that constant thing in my head. How's people going to take it? And, you know, I really got depressed about it, for years.
And did you contemplate suicide?
I did, definitely did. Like, I never attempted suicide or anything like that. Like, but it was always a thought in my mind. And I know depression can be kind of hereditary. Like, and I know it's in my family. Say, like, over the last 5 years, I've lost two uncles and an auntie to suicide. And it's all on the one side of my family. Like, so.
Was your mum's side or your dad's
side? Yeah, my mum's side.
And how do you think your mum will feel now listening to you on the radio today saying that you contemplated the same thing when you were younger?
Well,
that'd be very hurtful, very hard for her to listen to, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but she knows, you know, she knows that we've talked about it and she understands that, but she knows now, like, I'm completely happy. The last few years have been the happiest time of my life, like, basically since everybody in my family knew. From that day on, my father takes me, my life just changed, and just like a weight lifted off my shoulders from all that stress dealing with it, you know, for all them years, and then just in a second it just went away, and I couldn't be happier now, like.
So what would you say to people in your situation listening, or to their parents and siblings?
Yeah, well, I think there's parents that might have an inkling that there's something different maybe about their son or daughter. And instead of waiting for their son or daughter to come out, it'd be no harm just to ask them. And that if they ask them, then maybe they would just say it. And, you know, if they told them, if you are, we don't mind, you know, you can tell us. And then they don't have to go through the actual pressure of actually coming out and saying the words, because that's the hardest thing, is actually saying the words.
Ryan Dolan talking to Derek Mooney on Wednesday. Now, you'll have heard Ryan talking there about how difficult he found to tell his family he was gay. Well, on Thursday's Liveline, we heard a similar story from Chris, who had written to the show to tell them how it was only when he moved to Canada and fell in love that he was able to pluck up the courage to tell his mum, Helen, over the phone. Helen came on the line to tell Joe about her reaction to that phone call.
I was after coming home from a removal. Mm-hmm. of a friend of Christopher's who we had went to school with, mm-hmm. who had also been my sister's friend's son,
yeah,
same age as Chris, and seeing him in a coffin, you know, brought home to me, I'm lucky I have my son's, that poor girl. And I sat at home, I suppose, for half an hour thinking, like, oh good God, you know, I'm so lucky to have my kids.
Right.
She's burying her son tomorrow morning. And Chris rang.
Yeah.
And when he got upset then on the phone, I panicked. And all I wanted to know, are you okay? Are you healthy? And, you know, take your time then in telling me what you need to tell me. Once I knew he was healthy, but I don't think I will ever forget that phone call because my heart just left my chest.
And you said to him, as he told us, your reply when he told you he was gay, you said, is that it? I thought you were going to tell me you were sick.
Yeah. I was so relieved.
Helen, had you thought about it before?
I had once.
Hmm.
No, I didn't voice it, really. I thought to myself, you know, if he is, you know, he'll say it. But then again, I didn't want to, you know, I could be reading into things. So I kind of just put it at the side and just carried on, I suppose.
When he told you, obviously, you immediately realised he was going to tell other people.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that prospect?
I didn't care about other people. My worry would have been that I wanted Christopher to be happy because I knew for well over a year that he was very unhappy and I could not get out of him what was wrong with him. So, you know, that's it. That's what has been wrong with him. Now he can be happy. He can carry on.
What was the phrase you used, Chris? Can you remember the phrase, "Mom, I'm gay" or whatever?
I can't remember that.
Okay. I can.
What did he say, Helen?
You know, I never really went out with girls. I knew what he was telling me.
Yeah.
Helen and Chris talking to Joe Duffy on Thursday's Liveline. The tragic death of 18-year-old Johnny Byrne in Carlow last weekend, who died after he fell into a river after taking part in the online game Neck Nominate, was one which shocked and saddened in equal measures. Here is Father Joe and his brother Patrick talking in the aftermath of his death, as heard on Monday's Morning Ireland.
Well, I'm pleading to every youngster there to think of the things they are doing. It has cost my son his life. The whole family is devastated and our lives will never be the same again. I hope this message is heeded because for us, life is virtually over.
It's sad when it's after taking a loss of my brother, younger brother's life, for people to actually cop on to themselves and realise how stupid this game is. But I just want to broadcast to the public, I want, no matter what the cost is, I'm going to keep campaigning to have this Neck nomination taken off Facebook and done with for good.
Also on Monday's Morning Ireland, Aisling Kenny canvassed the opinion of some young people in Dublin for their views on Neck Nominate.
When I got nominated, I actually didn't want to get nominated at all, but you feel a pressure to do it because you don't want to be the person that stops the chain or whatever. So basically I just drank a beer, downed it. I actually didn't even finish it because I couldn't. I know from talking to my own friends, everyone's anxious, like, oh, I hope I don't get nominated, because you feel like you have to do it then. I think there's a pressure to do something different as well, like to stand out. It's all about like Facebook and how many likes you get and everything like that.
If I got nominated, I wouldn't. I'd probably just, you know, make a laugh and make a cup of tea. I wouldn't, you know, do the extreme thing, but that's just me.
Do you think it's a worrying trend?
It's the whole internet thing and everyone getting influenced and wanting to get likes on. It's a kind of like a social frenzy.
Do you think people think it's dangerous or is it just a bit of fun?
At the start, no. The majority of people who's doing it is probably like half locked already, but it's just a laugh. But obviously, like the last while, it's just gone too far.
I got Neck nominated and I'd done a funnel of 15 different alcohols. I think young lads that are trying to do, they try too much to prove themselves, whereas the lads that are doing it at the moment, like the 24 plus, know their limits.
I haven't tried it. I got nominated last night.
And when you were nominated, did you feel a sense of peer pressure to do it?
Yeah, the pressure on you from Facebook, your friends, people nominate you. You have to be more, you know, get your likes kind of thing, you know. People do like pints of vodka and doing cat food with vodka.
I think it's kind of like a chain and everyone who does it is afraid to break it in case their friends will then think why they have to break in the chain. But obviously, recently, last night, I just seen about that guy passing away. And I think that hopefully will make it a bit more aware to people our age group. Like, we're all 24, 25. It really shouldn't be something that we should have to do.
I have been nominated and I have done it, yeah. Dressed up as a woman and downed a pint of Guinness.
It's fair enough somebody downing a pint of beer, like one pint of beer, but people downing pints of whiskey and pints of vodka and that, it's just crazy. It makes no sense.
from Aisling Kenny's report on Monday's Morning Ireland. Prompted by the tragic death of Johnny Byrne, in her column in this week's Drive Time on Tuesday, Olivia O'Leary reflected on this country's attitude to drink. She opened her piece with a personal reflection on her own relationship with alcohol.
The day I decided to stop drinking my skull off was not the day that my Mini went into a tailspin and ended up crashing in reverse into a wall. Nor was it the day I realised that constant heavy drinking can help to make you depressed. The day I stopped drinking my skull off was a year later when I woke up in London and couldn't quite remember what had happened out on the town the night before. I was embarrassed at facing my English flatmates, socially embarrassed. I would not have been so socially embarrassed at home, I'm afraid. Social pressure can stop you drinking heavily, just as social pressure can start you. I started drinking heavily because it was part of the Irish macho culture of journalism. It was a male-dominated occupation back then. Those of us who were challenging the boys for the news and current affairs jobs had to prove we were as tough and as effective as they were. We felt we had to match them in the pub, drink for drink. It took us a while to realise that it wasn't a betrayal of the sisterhood to accept that women had less capacity for drink than men.
Olivia O'Leary is heard on Tuesday's Drive Time. Another death of another young Irishman occurred this week with the confirmation that a body had been found in London close to where 18-year-old DCU student Patrick Halpin had last been seen. On Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, John Skelly, the chairman of the Kilnadina Leitrim GA Club in Galway, gave his reaction to Patrick's death.
Patrick was a lovely fella, valued member of our club. And as I said, it was devastation to kill the man Lee from today, you know.
And he was somebody who played with you. He'd just broken 18 and had he got a scholarship to DCU?
He had, yeah. He won an actuary to DCU. He was a very talented fella, Patrick. He came to prominence in our club, I suppose he started under 12 and even under 10s. But 4 years ago, under 14 team won the Féile na Gael competition here in Galway and represented Galway, and Patrick was on that team and actually made the Galway development squad that year as well. So he's a good young fella. Then hurled under 16 with our club, hurled minor with our club. As late as last Sunday morning, was training with the lads with a minor and under 21, went out last Sunday morning and he was playing with them. And but outside of the hurling, he was a multi-talented guy, you know. He played football for Loughrea as well. They had an underage football team there. He played football with him, and I believe he's very good at the drama now as well, you know.
Which I suppose was what brought him to London in the first place.
Correct, yeah, absolutely. I believe he went to a show there in London on Tuesday or whatever, you know, and we're a bit numb at the minute, Sean, because, you know, yesterday there was hope all the way, and then yesterday, couldn't believe it, but you'd be tinged with fear. And then yesterday we hear that, you know, he's been found, and God, you can't believe it. It's you know, so rare that good news comes out of these things, and within the hour we're told, you know, it's a mistake, it wasn't him, and we had to wait another hour for it to be confirmed that it wasn't him, and the next thing we hear, the ultimate bad news. So it's the bottom. Our club are preparing for the All-Ireland Intermediate hurling final in Croke Park tomorrow. So there's been excitement all week in the parish, you know, and this thing is kind of like a bomb in the middle of the whole thing, you know.
I can well imagine it. There's no question of that match being called off or anything like that as a tribute?
No, Sean, I believe not. They're not Croke Park on the lawns kind of thing, and so we're going to wear our armbands and give the millions silence, and our club will galvanise ourselves to try and win it from Patrick's memory, you know.
John Skelly talking to Sean O'Rourke on Friday. Another young man heard on air this week was 27-year-old Martin Wright, who served a 4.5-year jail sentence when he was caught trafficking cocaine out of Chile. Following the high-profile case involving the imprisonment of an Irish woman, Peru, and similar charges recently, Martin has decided to go public with his story as a way of warning other young Irish people about the perils of becoming involved in this kind of activity. He was John Murray's guest in studio on Thursday, and at this point in the interview, he tells John about getting caught.
When I got to the airport and they actually opened the suitcase, it wasn't a special suitcase at all.
Right.
It was just your regular suitcase.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know. And you got through the customs at Santiago leaving Chile.
Yeah.
And you thought you had made it through when you got on the flight from Paris to Ireland. But in the story that you've told also to the Irish Sun, you tell us about that moment. You were on the plane.
Yeah.
You thought you were free.
Yeah.
Just take us back to that
moment. Yeah, so I got to Charles de Gaulle, and I flew from Chile to Charles de Gaulle. I had to go straight through to connect my flight for Dublin. And I remember getting on the bus to go to the flight, and a woman said, is there a Mr. Martin here? Is there a Mr. Martin? And that's my first name. So I thought I was caught then. So I showed her my passport. And she said, no, you're Mr. Rice. I'm looking for a Mr. Martin. So then I was like, phew. So I got on the plane then. And I sat down in my seat and had my seatbelt on. It must have been about 5 minutes before takeoff.
Incidentally, had you been taking drugs to make it all a little bit easier?
I had taken drugs before I left Chile, yeah.
To calm yourself?
Yeah.
What had you taken?
Just a few lines of cocaine, yeah.
So you were on the plane?
Thinking I was home free. And just, I remember this guy got on and I just remember the smell of BO off him. So I literally thought I was going to be sitting beside him the whole time. This guy stunk. And he just literally said to me, he was looking at me, looking at the seat number, looking at me, and he just said, can I see your passport, please? So I was kind of shocked. And he just said, yeah, there's a problem with your bag. You need to come with me. So I showed him my passport. I got up and he just asked me straight away, was there anything I wanted to declare? And I said no. Mm. Yeah. Even up until they brought me to the room where the suitcase was, they asked me, had I anything I wanted to declare? I still said no. Yeah. I tried to con them.
Right, but you didn't get by them.
No.
Martin Rice talking to John Murray on Thursday. The movie Philomena has generated a whole new level of awareness surrounding adoption stories in Ireland. And on Tuesdays Today with Sean O'Rourke, Brian O'Connell spoke to Dee Templeton and the son she hadn't seen in 44 years, Micheál Daly. Dee was sent to Bessborough House in Cork when she became pregnant at the age of 16 in 1969. She has since set up home in England and has three other children, but had always hoped to be reunited with her firstborn son. Micheál, on the other hand, was adopted into a loving family in rural Kerry and grew up thinking that both of his parents were dead. Here, Micheál describes how he received a letter from Dee on the same day that he received the memorial cards for his recently deceased adoptive father.
The day his memorial cards arrived in the post, so did the letter from Dee, my birth mother. And I got this overwhelming feeling that Dad was saying to me, well, my bit is done, you know, and let someone else take over kind of thing. And I can safely say that that's probably the first time that my legs ever went from under me. It was the most surreal experience, having the two things in your hand at the same time. And it starts off to say, dear Micheál, I fear this letter will come as a shock to you. There is no easy way to say that I believe I'm your birth mother. I've been trying to trace you for most of your life. I didn't give you up willingly, nor have I ever given up trying to find you. You were taken from me, but that is no bad reflection on your adopted parents, but on the corrupt system at the time. I don't want to overwhelm you with information at this stage, but I'm sure it must be obvious that my dearest wish is to get to know you. I last saw you when you were 10 weeks old. It broke my heart then, and I would like you to know that I have never had you out of my mind since. Every 4th of July, I had my own private little remembrance of you and hoped and prayed that you were well and happy. I tried everything to get information over the years without success. The Irish authorities have a vested interest in keeping these things close secrets, even now. If you're interested, I hope to be able to tell you in person how writing this letter finally became possible. You have my address above, but I can also be contacted by email. I know virtually nothing about you, so this letter is the hardest one I have ever written. How to find the right words. It will be a shock for you, and for this I'm more than sorry and hope you will understand that it's not something I undertook lightly. For almost 44 years, I've had to live with a burning need to know you were all right. I still need to know this. Please, please contact me. If it's easier for you, this can be done through an intermediary from the Adoption Rights Alliance. She suggested I handwrite this, but I was shaking so much it was just a mess. I hope to hear from you soon. With my very best wishes, Dee Templeton. Yeah, yeah, and I just feel upset even reading it now. You know, it was incredible.
Micheál Daly, as heard on Brian O'Connell's report on the Today Show on Tuesday. To mark the 30th anniversary of the death of Anne Lovett, who died at the age of 15, giving birth to her baby in a grotto in Granard, County Longford, the documentary on One rebroadcast Letters to Anne, a documentary which revisited the story 12 years later in 1996. In this excerpt, we hear John McKenna reading a letter he wrote to Anne Lovett, followed by a local man speaking to documentary maker Lorelei Harris.
I grew up in a town like yours, and I knew the need to prove myself. But for me, it was easy. I just bundled up my soul and kept it to myself. You put your soul, more than your soul, your life and soul, on the line. Said, here, this is me, and this is what I am. I knew other kids like you. I remember them. No heroics. Kids who knew nothing and in some way knew it all. But for me, it was easy. I see that now.
Well, the town first of all got bad publicity about it anyway for a start off. And it's difficult to say really, like, you know, like, but everybody seems to be harping upon it, like, you know, and taking advantage of it. If something good happened, like, it happens to a good many people. Say people in Granite, like, we get publicity all for the wrong reason. So I wouldn't have any more comment to make on it.
From Lorelei Harris's 1996 documentary Letters to Anne, as heard in the documentary in one slot on Saturday. A new series of Callan's Kicks started back on radio on Friday night. Here's an alternative commentary on yesterday's opening ceremony for the Winter Olympics.
Welcome back. Now it's over to Des Cahill, who's in Sochi for the opening ceremony of the Russian Winter Olympics. And Des, it promises to be some batch.
Hello, Sean. I wouldn't phrase it like that. You know, don't encourage them. But you've joined us now as the torch is being paraded through the streets of Sochi.
Oh, they do love a parade, those Russians.
And the torch is just now being passed to President Putin himself, who's going to ceremonial set it alight.
Right.
The last gay bar in Sochi.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And they're really enjoying this, Sean. Now the President's going to say a few words himself to declare the Olympics open, so we'll listen into this.
People of the world, welcome to Sochi in Russia, the least gay Winter Olympic in history. I have personally been riding around on horseback shirtless to inspect the facilities. Security will also be provided by our proud Russian soldiers and sailors in uniform. Thank you all, and please desist from any homosexualist activities or propaganda promoting the gay lifestyle. But now, men's figure skating!
From Friday's opening episode of a new series of Callan's Kicks, and that piece was also heard on yesterday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. You'll be hearing lots of in-depth analysis this weekend of today's game against Wales. On last week's Sunday with Miriam, however, when George Hook came into studio, he confessed all about his dietary requirements on a day when he's doing match analysis.
I don't know whether we can advertise or not, but I eat Bounty bars, right? So I consume 10 Bounty bars per match, okay?
What?
Yeah, and Ronan is sitting next to me, right? You know, like...
Are you serious or joking now?
Oh, no, word of honour. And I'm drinking tea and eating Bounty bars. And here is this guy, the pinnacle of physical fitness, and he's looking at me eating 10 Bounty bars. So they know me in the studio, so there'll be 10 more Bounty bars there today.
Oh, you're looking good in the Bounty bars anyway.
Yeah. Another man who revealed something about his diet this week, albeit from another era, was Operation Transformation leader Mark Gibbs, who told John Murray about how he met and fell in love with his wife, Sally.
I was in work and I decided to go next door to my favourite pizza shop, which was Tony's Pizza Stop. And I ordered my favourite pizza, number 14 on the menu, and had a glass of wine. And then I rambled up O'Connell Street towards me bus stop in Parnell Street to go home to Finglas.
Right.
And a very special woman caught me eye. A very special girl caught me eye. She was standing under the Eason's clock.
Yeah.
Which was my Sally.
I see. But just explain now, she wasn't waiting for you.
No, she was waiting on her boyfriend.
Okay.
Who I imagined when I was walking by and I looked at the clock and I saw the time, I said, you know, that girl looks a bit anxious. I bet your boyfriend's late.
Right.
So I decided to take advantage.
Okay.
So I rambled over to her and I said, you know, I mean, this is a terrible shot up line, John. But I said to her, have you been stood up?
an awful thing to say to the poor woman.
She told me to get lost.
Did she?
Yeah, she did.
Okay.
So I was walking away and I turned back around and I said, listen, I'm sorry. I said, that wasn't nice. I said, but I was walking by and I said, I looked at you. I thought you were gorgeous. and I thought I'd ask you to go for a drink.
I see.
And she says, no way.
Right.
So I turned on my heels. And, you know, I don't like giving up John, as you know.
Yes, I know that.
But she tapped me on the shoulder then. And she says, okay then. Just one.
Ah, you're some man. You're some man for one
and
man, Mark.
Absolutely thrilled, John.
Yes, I'm sure you were.
We went for a burger.
Lovely, you're a real man. You just had a pizza, Mark.
I just had a pizza. Well, you know what? We had a drink in between. It was all very quick. I had to impress her really, really quick, John.
Right.
I charmed her to bits, I did. Unbelievable. And gave her the whole spiel. And I walked her down to her taxi down there in Aston Quay. She was going home to Crumlin. And I gave her the phone number of my job. Because, John, we had no mobile phones. And I don't think we even had a house phone at the time. So I gave her the number of the job, and she rang me down a couple of days later.
Lovely.
Mark Gibbs talking to John Murray on Thursday. This week's drama on One, Lambo, by Hugh Travers, was adapted from a stage play of the same name, which featured an infamous radio incident in which the late Jerry Ryan supposedly killed a lamb as part of the Gay Byrne Show Survival Challenge. Here we hear Michael Ford Fitzgerald playing both Jerry and an interrogating Garda officer.
This is a criminal investigation, so we need full disclosure. Did you kill that lamb?
Okay, now I'm repeating myself. Surely there's a law against that. This is just getting messy now.
Stick to the facts, Mr. Ryan. Did you kill the lamb or not?
No, I did not.
But you said you did it on the radio.
I also said I did it on the telly. I say things, that's what I do.
You described it in detail.
I tell stories, that's my job.
But what about journalistic integrity?
I'm not a journalist. I'm a radio DJ.
So you didn't do it?
Jesus, no, I told you this. I swear, I did not kill that lamb. I would never do such a thing. Such a cruel, horrendous, barbaric thing. It's against the law. Of course not. Me, never.
So you lied to the hard-working housewives of Ireland on the radio, talking as if you were running around like Rambo. More like Lambo, am I right? Huh? Huh? How do you think those poor women will say when this gets out?
When this gets out?
How dare they, the cheek of them. I pay my licence fee every year, and this is the thanks I get. Barefaced lies in the radio. I wouldn't even mind if you'd killed the lamb, but lying about it, making up stories just for a bit of fun and games. Well, I'd expect it from that Jerry Ryan fella, but honestly, I'm very disappointed in Gay.
And what about your bosses at RTE? What do you think they'll say?
Who says they have to know? This interview is supposed to be confidential.
You're right, Jerry. Confidential. The Garda station is watertight. Good one.
Last week's drama on One, Lambo, which was written by Hugh Travers, directed by Ronan Phelan and acted by Michael Ford Fitzgerald. Lambs also featured in Thursday night's Book on One, in which Selena Guinness reads from her novel The Crocodile by the Door. In this excerpt, she describes how her husband Colin delivers his first lamb.
Eventually, Colin manages to get two fingers inside, and then his whole hand slides in suddenly until his wrist disappears beneath the lamb's head. The lambing aid has slipped and is dangling uselessly from his elbow like some sort of charm bracelet. Colin's face contorts with pain each time the yoke contracts. I dare not say anything. Later he'll tell me the pelvic bones felt like knives slicing across his knuckles. The cry of a lamb down the field momentarily catches my attention. It sounds so like Kim. The torch dips and Colin swears. His head is twisted sideways as he gropes for something identifiable inside the yoke. We stand there for what seems an age, waiting, before his face suddenly relaxes and he draws a front hoof forwards. The lamb now looks as if it's peeking out of a woolly porthole for one last view. Colin reaches back in and by twisting the head a little sideways, fetches out a second black hoof. He stands to straighten out his back for a minute. That's it now, I think, he says, with some satisfaction. He bends again and takes a tight grip on each hoof and pulls steadily downwards. With a tremendous gush of liquid, the hot body finally slides to earth with a thud. We stand back, the sense of victory fading as we watch the yo attempt to nuzzle her big lamb to life. Siobhan crouches down next to the limp creature. With a handful of grass, she begins to brush away the amniotic fluid from around its nose, then rubs its wet flanks briskly up and down. "Come on, come on," she mutters, but there is no sign of the lamb breathing. She sits back for a moment and looks up at us, her eyes shining with determination. "Would you mind if I..." she begins to ask, but Colin is already nodding. So she picks the lamb up by its hind legs and, stepping back from the mother, starts to swing it heavily from side to side. And there it is suddenly, the convulsion and tiny cough as the lamb takes its first breath. The cord must have kept it alive through all that straining.
Selina Guinness reading from her novel The Crocodile by the Door on Thursday's Book on One. You hardly need me to tell you that Garth Brooks is coming to Croke Park this summer. This week he added an extra 2 Dublin dates to the tour, and on Monday morning he spoke to John Murray shortly after he had added one extra gig to the lineup. He told John how it didn't take much to persuade him.
They called back and asked if we would think about additional shows, and I told them, look, I live in Ireland, you know, if you guys would let me in, and if they want additional, if they want an additional show, count me in. That's just more fun.
Yes, so you've confirmed this morning that you and your band and your entourage are going to do not 3 but 4 gigs.
Yeah, we're going to put the 4th one on sale and make sure that anybody that wanted a ticket that didn't get one is going to get one, because as happy as you guys have made me in my life, that's all I want to do, is make people happy there. And it's a wonderful place to play music. So staying the next day is big for us, and we're all excited.
Yeah, it just, I know you said you were stunned, but to think that the last time you played here, 17 years ago, and to imagine that all the people who obviously went to see you then, and a whole new generation of Garth Brooks followers, voted with their money on Thursday that they wanted more.
Yeah, you know, when we were there in Ireland a couple of weeks ago, there were people that talked about, you know, the tour and wanting to see the live show. And I'm looking at them going, these people weren't even born yet, you know, when we were here last time. So the interest is very sweet. It's very flattering. It's very humbling. And I can't tell you how excited I was to get the news and how excited I am today to be part of some new news.
I'm just looking at it then. Garth, Friday, Saturday, Sunday and Monday. You're going to have to go into training for this.
Yeah, and you got to know how precious Monday is. And when they said, hey, can we do Monday? The first answer was no, because that is my baby's 18th birthday. It's our youngest. She turns, you know, you only turn 18 once in your life. And I figured she wanted to be back here in the States with her friends. And she said, Dad, I would love to spend my 18th birthday in Ireland. Can I get a tattoo? And I thought, oh, crap, here we go. And so she's very excited about getting to spend her 18th birthday there, and so are we. So it's going to be a very special day.
And did you give her the go-ahead for the tattoo?
We're negotiating right now.
Garth Brooks talking to John Murray on Monday about those Dublin gigs and his daughter's possible tattoo. That's about my lot for this week to play us out. Orla Gartland from Drumcondra in Dublin came in to play live on the John Murray show this week. This is her rendition of the Lord's Song Royals as heard on Friday. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my dress. In a torn up town, no postcode envy, but every song's like old teeth, grey goose tripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care. Driving Cadillacs in our dreams, and everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We're not caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals. No, it don't run in our blood. That kind of looks just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler. You can call me Queen Bee. That fantasy. friends and I, we've cracked the code. We count our dollars on the trains to the parties, and everyone who knows us knows that we're fine with this. We didn't come from money, but every song's like gold teeth, grey goose chipping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care. We're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, and everybody's like crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We're not caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals. No, it's all running our blood. That kind of looks just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler. You can call me Queen Bee. Fantasy.